Hello, I'm Fred Stella, president of the Interfaith Dialogue Association. Welcome to another edition of Common Threads. Last week, we began our conversation with Professor Kelly James Clark about his new book, Strangers, Neighbors, Friends, Muslim, Christian, Jewish Reflections on Compassion and Peace. It's a book he wrote with two other authors, Aziz Abu Sarah and Rabbi Nancy Fuchs Kramer. Kelly is a colleague of mine. He works here at the Kauffman Interfaith Institute, and Kauffman Interfaith Institute is a part of, well, I should say Interfaith Dialogue Association is a part of the Kauffman Interfaith Institute. A little bit about Kelly. He's a senior research fellow here at Kauffman, which is housed at Grand Valley State University. And he is the author, editor, or co-author of more than 25 books, including Abraham's Children, Liberty and Tolerance in an Age of Religious Conflict, and also the book Religion and the Sciences of Origins. So we welcome once again to Common Threads, Kelly Clark. Hi, Kelly.
Hi, Fred. Thanks for having me back.
Certainly. So last week we talked really quite a bit about the contribution of your co-author, Aziz Abu Sarah, who is a Palestinian and is now involved in tremendous peace work. So let's move on to your contributions, if you will, and then later on in the program to the rabbis. When you wrote this book, what were you trying to convey more than anything else in the many chapters? How many chapters? Do you remember how many?
We each wrote about 15 chapters.
Okay, yeah. And I should say, I mentioned this last week, these are very short chapters, maybe 3 pages, something like that. Very readable, not heavy theology, but at the same time, you walk away knowing a lot more about the tradition you're reading about, whether it's Islam, Christianity, or Judaism. So if you're looking for sort of an introduction into interfaith dialogue, it's a great book to start with. So now that I've said that, you know, you obviously were going for stories. You talked about stories, for instance, the one about picking up the homeless person. So what is the common thread of these stories, if I may, got them in this book?
So let me tell that story, because the book is, I can say what the book is about in one way, or I can tell a story so people get a sense. I was a youth director in Iowa for a year, and I had taught the Good Samaritan. We did it as a group, and you know, the Good Samaritan, there's a stranger on the side of the road, and the stranger's obviously in need, and some religious leaders walk by, but they're in a hurry, so they look over and they scurry on, and then finally the Samaritan stops and helps the person. And so I taught this in the Sunday school, or not, it was an evening class, midweek, Wednesday evening class, and I'm driving home. It's in January or February, and there's a huge blizzard that's coming up. I could barely see, and I look over on the side of the road on entrance ramp to get onto Highway 80, and there's a guy just sitting there on the side of the road. And I was in a hurry to get home, and it was cold, and I saw this guy, and I just couldn't not stop. I thought, we just did this in Sunday school class. How can I not stop? And so I pulled over and picked the guy up, asked him what he was doing. He had been there for a long time, and he was freezing, and he was just about ready to give up, and he was just going to lay down and die, I guess.
Wait, was he hitchhiking or what? What?
I think at one time he'd been hitchhiking, but I think when I went by, he was just sitting there on the side of the road. And it was an entrance ramp to the road, so it was to a highway, to Interstate 80, so people don't just sit there.
Sure.
So I pulled over and said, you know, do you need some help? And he said, yeah. And he got in, and then he told me he had just decided to give up. So I'm saying, you know, what do you do? And he says, I'm trying to get to Omaha, which is another couple of hundred miles, and it's 9:30 at night, and no one's going to pick him up. And it's a terrible blizzard. So I said, all right, well, let me bring you home. And as he's driving home, I found out he was an alcoholic and a drug addict. And
he was quite forthcoming about all that?
Yeah. And but I bring him home anyway, and I bring him in. I'm married. My wife's there, and she's up sleeping already. She had to get up early for work, and I walk upstairs, and she said, so, you know, how you doing? What's going on? I said, well, there's a guy sleeping downstairs, and well, he's an alcoholic and a drug addict, and I just picked him up on the side of the road, and she was not happy. And
so this wife of which you speak, is she still married to you?
Yeah, still. Oh, okay. Yeah,
all right. Good.
Surprise, surprise. And then, I heard him rumbling around downstairs, and I looked out, and we had a patio in the back, and he was urinating off the patio.
And I read that in the book. I mean, really, what's the matter with that if there was no other option?
Well, there is another one. He could have walked upstairs. We did have a bathroom, but still, you know, it was hearing the door open and you know, like, we had no valuables. We were just married. He could have taken our best stainless. I don't know. It wouldn't have mattered one bit. He could have taken anything we had. It was worth nothing. But still, I thought he was absconding with our best stainless, I guess. And so I look out, and he's urinating. It's okay, back to sleep. And then I hear him wrestling around some more, and then I come downstairs. My wife says, no, you have to take him to a hotel. You have to pay for him to go to a hotel. And so I come downstairs, and I'm ready to take him to the hotel, and he's reading the Bible. and he starts crying, and I just talked to him, and he didn't like his life. He wanted to change his life. He hated his life, and in the end, he stayed the night, and then I bought him a bus ticket to Omaha, and I called a pastor of another church in the denomination I was in, and guess what? They had a center for alcohol and drug rehabilitation. So my homeless guy agreed to be picked up by this guy and taken into a rehab center. So anyway. I'll just give an interesting anecdote.
Yeah.
At Princeton Seminary, some psychologists did an experiment, and they had seminarians prepare to give speeches on the Good Samaritan story. And these are psychologists who are involved, and that the seminarians, half of them are told to hurry to go give their sermon, and half of them are told to just go give their sermon at various times. And the ones who are going to give a sermon on the Good Samaritan, who are told to hurry, the psychologist planted a person on the street in need. And the ones who were in a hurry to go and give a sermon on the Good Samaritan didn't stop and help. And the ones who had time to stop and help, they stopped and helped. And they found out, we're not that good. People aren't that good. Anyway, I think if people listen to the gospel, they see how radical it is to stop and help people on the side of the road in need, even if they're drug addicts, or you don't get to ask. Like, you don't, the whole point of the story is you don't get to ask if they're, like, worthy of your attention. You can't ask if they're Muslim or Arab or Christian or Jew, or they're like you or not like you. You don't get to ask that. If they're in need, the neighbor is the person who stops. Anyway, I guess the big, I don't have one theme that it all works for. I look at a lot of things that the New Testament says about compassion and peace, and how radical its demand is that we work for peace and harmony, and I have one on loving your enemy. Jesus says to love your enemy, and we act like, you know, we hear this over and over, so it just like washes over us like nothing. But
because maybe we're thinking of some unnamed Taliban army recruit, you know, somebody over there that's never going to touch our lives.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Or I think that people don't think, like, Jesus really knew what enemies were. Of course, he did end up on a cross.
Yeah.
He did have people that threw stuff at him that wanted to drive him all over a cliff. He did have Romans who didn't like what he did and viewed him as a threat. They knew what enemies were. And then Jesus says, love your enemy. And then there are all these enemies in the Gospels that become part of the kingdom. The Roman centurion, the whole point of that story is that person was loved, even though he was a threat and people feared him. He was loved by people so that he becomes part of the kingdom. The person that stops and helps the stranger is the Samaritan, and the Samaritans were outcasts. The enemy was the compassionate one. And so Jesus tells these stories with little twists in them that would have been heard differently. And they would have shocked people who heard them. And they don't shock us anymore. And what I mostly do, Aziz tells stories about his life. I try to tell the stories that, mostly I tell stories that Jesus had to get him to shock us again. And I ask each of the writers to speak to their own communities, from their traditions. I try to speak to Christians from my community and from my tradition, but I feel like I had to rescue the gospel from the tradition, which has kind of tamed it, I guess. And we don't see how radical it is.
That's a good word for it, yeah.
And so then we think it's okay for us to go to Iraq and drop bombs on innocent people, and that God's calling us to do it. And God bless America, we say, as we go and drop bombs on innocent people. And no one, by the way, has killed more innocent people in the world in the last 10 years than Americans, and it's not even close. 3,000 people were killed in 9/11, and we've killed probably, at a minimum, 800,000 in Iraq, and there wasn't a single Iraqi that dropped a bomb, that flew their planes into the towers. And so we invaded the wrong country, and we've killed at least 800,000, other estimates are up to 1.5 million innocent people have died as a result of that. And we do it in the name of God. And I'm trying to speak to that community and say, God is not on the side of violence like that.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Common Threads on WGVU. I'm Fred Stella, and with me today is Professor Kelly James Clark. He is the co-author of the book Strangers, Neighbors, Friends, Muslim, Christian, Jewish Reflections on Compassion and Peace. So let's talk about the rabbis' additions or contributions to your book here. Her name is Nancy Fuchs Kramer, and how did you connect with her?
I actually didn't know Nancy at all. I knew Aziz and wanted to partner with Aziz for a long time, but because he had such great stories. Nancy, I didn't know, and I had actually invited someone else, and she had some health problems, so she backed out, and she recommended Nancy. And so I looked up what Nancy does. She's a rabbi. She teaches in a seminary. She teaches interfaith, not just studies, but they do interfaith at her seminary. And then she's also involved initially with before 9/11, there's the before 9/11 interfaith, and it's and you know this because you don't fit into the narrative, but it was mostly Jew. A lot of Christians felt bad after the Holocaust, so it was Protestant, Catholic, Jew. That was interfaith, by and large, sure. Prior to 9/11. After 9/11, in America, it became Muslim, Christian, Jew. And then she's a few years older than I am, so she was starting this pre 9/11, and then there's what she was doing then. After 9/11, she does a lot of things where she stands in solidarity, mainly with Muslim sisters, I guess. She's in different organizations where they do projects, retreats, trying to build peace between those two communities. That's mainly what she does.
It's interesting because 9/11 comes up a few times in the book, from the authors there.
Yeah.
Because it certainly is a watershed moment in interfaith relations. She tells the story in there, which is so profound. It really needs to continue to be told about the Islamic center that was attempted to have built not far from Ground Zero, and how people were opposing that. They were calling it a victory mosque. It was the most offensive thing, and even President Obama did not stand up for those people. He said, he didn't say don't do it. He says he didn't know if it was the smartest idea or something like that. Do you remember that?
Yeah. Yeah. No, I wrote about it. It was a shame. We believe in religious liberty for Christians.
Yes.
And if we're going to have religious liberty, it applies to everybody equally. And after 9/11, there were difficulties all over the country for Muslims to build mosques. The most grievous and most famous it wasn't a mosque.
It was a center,
and it was near 9/11. And it was built by a Muslim who is deeply committed to interfaith harmony.
Right.
And so it was exactly what you would want. Although, here's the thing about religious liberty. We also ought to be open to it being a place we don't really want, you know.
Yes.
They don't have to be people like us, you know. That's the whole point of religious liberty.
Yeah. Two things that come to mind that were really tragic. First of all, I heard a disc jockey trying to be funny on the radio saying, "Oh yeah, you hear about this news there, they want to build," he probably said mosque. I don't know.
Oh, yeah. Everybody said mosque.
Trying to build a mosque near Ground Zero. Wouldn't that be like trying to build a Benihana at Pearl Harbor? Oh, my gosh. And then there was a talk show on another public radio station here in Grand Rapids where when this was a controversy, when it was happening, there was an elected official from Kentwood. I don't remember his name. But I remember that elected official from Kentwood as a guest, and he started talking about it, and I called in. I was just flummoxed, trying to educate people on exactly what this was. And it was like what those Fox hosts that just hit those talking points over and over. No matter what I would say, he referred to it as a victory mosque. That's just...
Yeah, now they get their dogs with bones when they get on this.
Absolutely.
And they control the microphone, so you can't win.
Yeah, yeah. Well, fortunately, he was just a guest. He wasn't the host. If he was a host, I wouldn't even attempt to it, because you're right. They got the talking stick. They're not going to let you make a solid point. And the guest, the host, he was willing to listen, thank God.
Yeah.
Yeah, he was reasonable. As we were going at it, in the book, one chapter that is common to you all is what have I learned from blank and blank. So in your case, it would have been, what have I learned from Muslims and Jews? And Nancy wrote, what have I learned from Muslims and Christians, etc. I think that's very important. Tell me your story. What did you learn?
All right. I will say that's the only chapter I ask people to write. What have you learned from other traditions? Let me tell you, I don't know how much time we have left, so I...
Keep talking. About 10 minutes.
Okay. So there's plenty. So when I went to my first trip to Turkey. So this is my first trip to a Muslim-majority country. And I had dinner in the home of a pretty conservative Muslim family, and they made dinner for us. And I was raised as a Protestant Christian, and the way I was raised was that Catholics were all going to hell because they believed in they were going to get into heaven by works, not by grace. So I was raised thinking Catholics were pretty bad, even though I knew a few of them, that they were still pretty bad. But Muslims were the worst because At least Catholics believe in faith plus works, but Muslims, it's like all work. So Muslims are the worst. And so Muslims were the most vilified. And I got my PhD at Notre Dame, and I met some Catholics, and I thought, well, maybe these Catholics aren't so bad. And turns out they believe things pretty close to what I believed. And anyway, it wasn't hard to accommodate Catholics, but it wasn't easy. I mean, the way I was cultured was very exclusionary, but still Muslims are evil. That's the, you know, and so I went on my first trip, and I was trying, you know, I had been making a lot of headway and getting better with thinking about Muslims, but still I had this sort of cultural baggage, sociocultural baggage I was bringing along with me. And, you know, one of the worst things was praying five times a day. Just thought, man, sort of forced prayer. Like, I was Protestant. I wouldn't even bow. And if I went to a Catholic church and people bowed, I sort of proudly didn't bow. Now it was pride that kept me from bowing. But anyway, so they would pray five times a day. Well, we're at a dinner, and somebody gets up, and he actually was the guy that does the call to prayer in his neighborhood. So he was going off to do the call to prayer. And, you know, I said, see you later. And then we actually heard his voice maybe 20 minutes later. You could hear him over the call to prayer. And then one person would get up, our host's family would get up and leave and then come back. And then another host member would get up and leave and come back. And then another one. And I thought they all were going to the bathroom or something. And finally, I just asked, like, where's everyone going? Because I thought if you did call to prayer, you went to the mosque. It turns out they were going to a room where people prayed. They had a room, and they had a carpet on the floor. But not one of them said where they were going. Not one of them called any attention to it. And they brought me in there, and they showed what they were doing and explained. And then I started reading what they pray, and they pray to God, and they say, there is no God but Allah. And what they're saying is there's just one God. Over and over, there's just one God. There's one God. Anyway, after a while, I just began to think, you know, bowing down five times a day, bowing down saying there's just one God, is you trying to get your body and your spirit aligned, and you're saying this over and over. Minimally, you're saying this, I'm not God. I'm not God. There's just one. I view it as a way to sort of have movement of body and movement of spirit in a way that cultivates a virtue. And the virtue is that pride is diminished. So that's one really cool thing I've learned from Muslims. Like, it doesn't bother me. I think it's a beautiful thing to see now. I think atheist, Christian, Protestant, Catholic, Hindu, everybody would benefit five times a day, bowing down their heads to the ground, saying, I am not God.
You know, I don't remember whether this, I think that the saying comes from either Buddhism or Hinduism. It could be Jainism. I'm not sure, but I think it's either Buddhism or Hinduism. The saying is, where the body goes, the mind will follow.
Yeah. I've come to think that actually ritual movement...
Yeah,
is really powerful. I used to not think that, and it's, you know, as a Protestant, it's all a matter of having the right beliefs, and you got to get yourself into the right beliefs. And now I think, that is important, but moving our bodies in various ways with other people, even like singing together. If you and I just sing together, we'll like each other better.
Yes,
and if we're singing and swaying a little bit, we'll like each other even a little bit more.
No, this is true. Hey, we're coming down to the wire once again, Kelly. I want to thank you so much for the time you spent with us today and last week as well. Last week, you were kind of hazy on that website.
Oh, yeah.
I think you may have had an opportunity to check things out. I believe you said, you know, kellyjamesclark.wixsite.com.
Yep.
That's WIXSITE.
Right. Yep. Okay. That's it.
And also, you've got a Facebook page. Tell us about that.
Yeah, I have a Facebook page. I have my own personal page, but I have one with a lot of followers called Abraham's Children. And I have some people that help me with it, but we try to keep our nose to the ground for good examples of religion, the things that don't make the news. And we're trying to normalize people's views of religious folks, especially Muslims, who are viewed sort of in the West as terrorists or people that we should fear. And we're trying to normalize people's views of Muslims by, for example, showing them I think it was 13 people were killed in a synagogue in Pittsburgh by a white extremist. Muslim groups raised over $1 million, I think, in charity for that mosque. And there are a lot of beautiful stories.
You mean for the synagogue?
Sorry, for the synagogue, yeah. There are lots of beautiful stories of compassion on the part of Muslims, and we're trying to show that side of Muslims in Islam.
And do you allow people, obviously you'd have to be the person who makes the decision, but if a follower on Facebook comes across a story and wants to post it, are they able to as well, or does it go through
you? I don't know, actually, if they're... We're pretty generous in what we post, so if they sent it to us and asked to post it, we would almost certainly post it. But because we're always... We want it to be...
Interactive?
Sort of, yeah, we want it to be filled with news. We want people to know
right
how religion properly understood can motivate peace and compassion, not violence and hatred.
I get that. Well, thank you very much, Kelly. You've been listening to Common Threads here on WGVU. I'm Fred Stella, and Kelly James Clark has been my guest today once again, and talking about the book Strangers, Neighbors, Friends, Muslim, Christian, Jewish Reflections on Compassion and Peace. Please join us again next week right here on WGVU-FM for another edition of Common Threads.